Today's episode of Tech Talks on the Unsettled Media Podcast Network is brought to you by Tech Impact, focused on unlocking prosperity by embracing technology. For more, head to techimpact.it.
Welcome back, or welcome to Tech Talks with Kathy Simpson. I'm your host and the CEO of Tech Impact. If you're not familiar with who we are, we're a private sector-led industry group focused on growing the Atlantic Canadian IT workforce and economy through the use of technology. If you're new to the podcast, we started Tech Talks in the fall of 2020, and this is episode 24. We took a little break as we were ramping up some team members and launching our new Digital Boost 2.0 program, but we're back and very excited to continue these conversations. One of the aspects of the podcast that I thoroughly enjoy is the opportunity to connect with leaders in our innovation, entrepreneurial, and technology community. It's not just the podcast conversation, but it's the preparation and research. It's the picking of the guests and topics to discuss, and then the planning that goes into each episode. And finally, the work afterwards to get everything ready and make it available to all of you. Every episode is a learning experience for me and hopefully for you as well. I am really excited about this episode. I've known this guest for well over a year now, and it is Jody Glidden, the CEO of IntroHive. You might be thinking that the reason I'm so excited to have Jody on the show is for him to talk about the $100 million U.S. financing round that IntroHive just raised. Yes, you heard me right, $100 million U.S. Series C round. Let that sink in a little bit. It's absolutely phenomenal and the largest equity investment in the province of New Brunswick's history. IntroHive has offices now in multiple countries, but more than half of the 300 or so workforce are in Atlantic Canada, whether that be St. John, Fredericton, or Halifax. That's something special for all of us to celebrate, living here in Atlantic Canada and beyond. And we do talk about this on the podcast. However, I'm excited for you to get to know Jody, the entrepreneur. I knew when we were researching his background that we really needed to dive into his past and history that led him to being a serial entrepreneur. Jody hails from Miramichi, has his undergrad degree from UMB, and you'll learn more about this on the show. He's lived in Canada and the U.S., and for the past 20-plus years, he's been involved in startups that he's joined or founded. So, if you're a founder or CEO looking to grow, Jody's about to teach a masterclass for us all. He's a lifelong entrepreneur, and we go right back to the Miramichi, the importance of family, particularly his mom, his elementary school first foray into business ownership, and I say that loosely, and then he takes us all on some incredible twists and turns in his personal entrepreneurial story. That's what I really wanted to get at in our discussion. If you're wondering what it takes to have success as an entrepreneur, settle in and have a listen. You will likely put this episode on repeat and recommend it to your team to have a listen to. So great to be back with all of you and to have Jody join us. So let's dive right into the show. Welcome, everybody, to Tech Talks with Kathy Simpson. I'm thrilled to be here today on this beautiful day in June. And I've got a wonderful New Brunswick guest, even though he's not sitting in New Brunswick at this moment in time. My guest today is Jody Glidden, and we're going to talk a whole bunch about his journey into entrepreneurship. But maybe, Jody, we'll start with you introducing yourself a little bit.
Yeah, thanks, Kathy. I'm glad to be here. Yeah, I'm Jody Glidden. I grew up in Miramichi, New Brunswick, and I guess I lived in Miramichi, you know, all through my school years.
How did you decide what you were going to study when you left the Miramichi?
I probably didn't take the straightest path. My original plan, when I was younger, I was just very interested in doing something in business. I started a lot of little fledgling businesses when I was a kid and a teenager and so on. I knew I wanted to do something in business. And then I also had been tinkering around a lot all through my childhood with computers. So in high school, somebody came to the school and said, you know, from UNB and was talking about computer science and how computers may be the next big thing. I think this was around 1989 or 1990. and so I thought, a bunch of my friends were like, well, hey, let's do that. That's an idea. Let's do that. And so I was like, well, I want to go where all my friends are going and do the things that all my friends are doing. And so that's what I did. I went to go to UNB originally thinking I wanted to do computer science.
So before we get into UNB, will you share what some of those little fledgling businesses were? I taught piano lessons, made a killing at it, by the way, so I get it. So what were some of the things that you did?
Yeah, mine were unusual. So like in grade five, there was a big thing that was trending around like ninja movies and Bruce Lee and all this kind of stuff was really all the rage at the time. And so I had made myself a set of these, what they call nunchucks, you know, it's like you've probably seen nunchucks before. So I went to my father's wood shop and took a broom handle and cut it up into the two pieces that I needed, wrapped them with black tape and got a piece of chain from Canadian Tire and made it into a set of nunchucks that worked pretty well. Brought them to school and first thing, all of my friends were saying, oh my God, I would love to have those. So then I thought, well, these things only cost me about $1.50 to make. And I think I could sell them for about $5. So I went and got my mother to bring me to Canadian Tire and we just loaded up. And I started like an assembly line with a couple of my friends where we were just like making a whole lot of these. And then I brought them to school and put them all in my backpack, sold out on the first day, went back and just kept doing that over and over until one day, there was a knock on my door and it was the police. And they said to my mother, did you realize that your son is selling weapons at school? I hadn't really thought of it that way, but that was the end of my first business.
But you had a profit to be able to enable you to do your next one.
Yeah, that's right. So the next thing was there were sports cards. A few years later, sports cards started becoming a big thing, like hockey cards and baseball cards and all that kind of stuff. And so I just realized that everybody was using for the pricing of the cards of these, you know, various different rookie cards or whatever they were all using the same source, which is this thing called the Beckett Guide. And it hit the stores on all the same day for everybody. So I thought, well, what if I could become a wholesaler and actually get access to it a day before everybody else. And so I had to go through this long process of trying to figure out how to become a distributor for Beckett and all this kind of stuff. Long story short, I got the guide and that was my most profitable business ever. Cause I would find out, you know, I'd kind of run the arbitrage. I'd find out what was going to be moving the most. I'd go buy up all those cards and then I'd wait a few days and then I'd go sell them all back to all the different people and stuff like that. And I made enough, I think I was 13 or so at the time, but I made enough to buy a car. It wasn't a great car, but it was a car. And so that was my second business. And that all culminated in I guess the summer was over and then somehow I left I had all these really valuable ones that I was saving and it ended up somebody broke into my car one day when I left it under my seat and they stole them all. And that was the end of it. I just got discouraged and stopped.
Oh my gosh. Did you have entrepreneurs in the family? What got you started?
Yeah. So my mom started an aesthetics salon. Mm-hmm. Each of my sisters started salons. So if anybody's from Miramichi, they'd know those salons. They had a couple of them. The various different members of the family. And my father had the biggest business, which was a fire protection company. He had, I think, the biggest fire protection company in the province. So it just seemed like an attractive thing to do, you know, kind of giving you some freedom, you know, and I didn't really understand the risks of business back then. Everything just looked like upside and no downside.
But you didn't grow up thinking, I'm going to go work for the telephone company or the power company or the government. That wasn't in your family heritage right around you.
Yeah. No, I didn't. There were definitely moments where I'd get caught up in, you know, I want to be an astronaut or I want to be like, a lawyer or something like that. But it just kept coming back to maybe I might want to start something.
So when I did some digging into your background, you didn't take the straight path at university. And I think that's really interesting because so many people can get discouraged if they don't take that straight path and everything doesn't quite work out. So why don't you talk to us about starting and stopping and how you found your way back to school and what did you learn along that process? So take your time, you know, tell us when you got started.
Yeah, sure. So, you're definitely right. I had a friend that was over here last week from Canada. He was down here for the Bitcoin conference and he graduated from UNB. He's younger than me, but he graduated slightly a few years before me. We got talking about the graduating year and he's like, wait a second, you're older than me. How did you graduate from UNB in 2005? And I said, I took a gap year and like, really, it was a gap decade. So what happened was I got enrolled in my first year and I started in a lot of the computer science courses and I was having a really hard time to feel engaged. It was probably a couple of reasons. One, probably my maturity level at the time. Second, just, you know, shinier things out there that I thought I might be interested in doing. And then also just like, I had so many years of entry-level programming experience. You know, I started doing computer programming when I was like grade 3. And so it was difficult to feel engaged in those courses. And so, yeah, I just ended up, having a horrible first year. Attending almost no classes and just... Then I ended up deciding to go do something else. The first really notable thing was I had been doing a bunch of Microsoft certifications. This was around maybe 1994 or so. And I got a call from somebody saying that there was a startup, which I didn't even really know what a startup was at that time. It was a startup that was just starting in Fredericton, called scholars.com, run by Ben Watson at the time and Ken Anderson, and that they were looking for people who had Microsoft certifications, and there were barely any people in the province that had them. And so I think Microsoft had given my name as somebody who had a bunch. And so, they called me, and I ended up, at the time, I was working at some other place for $50,000 a year, I remember, and Ben's pitch to me was, you know, you come work here. The starting salary is $25,000 a year, so it's literally half. but you'll be able to grow faster because once you hit this certain number of certifications, you'll get we'll put you to $60,000 a year. And so I was just like super driven at that time.
You became a machine.
Yeah. I don't know if you heard the story, but I like broke all the records that they had and like how, you know, generally people were doing a certification every couple of months. And I think I knocked out like 6 certifications in 6 weeks or something like that. I barely slept and just, you know, did them at a really, really fast pace. So then they ended up, it caught the attention of Ken Anderson and Ben and some other people there. And they put me in charge of all of the people who were teaching certifications. So I led the learning advisor division for a while. A few months into that, had this idea that that there might be a better way to organize all of the students' learning if we just built a computer-based system, like a web-based system that could kind of guide them through the whole process. And so they were like, well, go ahead and do it. You know, so I like hired some people and ended up leading also the team that built that product. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, they gave me more and more and more. By the end of it, I think I had something like 80 of the 100 or so staff. And then we were acquired in large part due to, you know, this product that we had built.
The automation.
So that was, it was basically maybe one of the world's first learning management systems. You know, we didn't think of it that way at the time, but that's really what it was. It was so early, you know, back then. It was like the early 90s or something. So,
but let's put it into perspective. You would have been 20?
Yeah. Yeah, I was like maybe, yeah, I was like maybe 22 or something, like 23. I was pretty young. So, looking back at it, it seems crazy to me, you know, that I was, I remember at the time still feeling like that wasn't enough. You know, I felt like, why am I not like, why don't I have my own company? But it's kind of, it seems ridiculous that at that age, I felt like
it wasn't enough.
Yeah.
But it's so true. That happens to so many people.
Yeah, I think when you're that young, you don't realize how much you still have to learn. You know, you just think you know everything, and you don't understand why other people are like running things, and just, you know, it's kind of strange, but that's the way it is.
So was it at that time when you realized you were seeing someone running their own company, did it start to occur to you that you had a big contribution to this startup and that this startup life is kind of interesting? Were you able to put those connections together?
Yeah. I was probably overconfident, but I felt like that I played a really big part in this thing, and I knew knew everything I needed to know to go do a successful startup myself. I didn't realize that the whole financing side of the business and accounting and HR really were, a lot of HR was really outside of my purview. It was everything delivery that was within what I was doing. Mm-hmm. And so I did go and start a company right after that. I started a company called IC Global. And I had to learn all that kind of stuff. And I felt like my biggest struggle, and although we did end up very successful, but I would say that the biggest struggle was it was the sales side of it, like not understanding. We'd hire a sales leader, and I didn't understand why we weren't selling things at first. I had never really been in charge of sales, so I couldn't diagnose the problem, couldn't really fix it. You know, we were lucky enough to have a great product, and we got the attention of Gartner, and they published us as like the top product in six categories, and so the leads just started flowing in, and it. You know, was shooting fish in a barrel after that. But from the sales side, I really was, I would say, looking back, I was probably pretty weak.
So how did you start the process of going from I'm the development guy and I know how to build the product and I know what the product needs to be to, oh, I now need to run the company and I need to understand sales and talent and HR and finance? How did you make that transition back then?
Well, I learned, you know, you kind of inevitably, when you have a decent sized team, like I did at Scholars, you learn a lot about people issues without anybody teaching you. And, but there's a lot you still don't know. On the sales side, I had been involved in almost every big deal that Scholars sold. And so I was overhearing it, but I had never been in charge of a sales team and didn't really understand pipeline management and all those kinds of things, right? And I was never directly responsible for prospecting. And that was another piece I really didn't know at the time. So, you know, what ended up happening is IC Global was acquired by the company that is now Skillsoft. So that was the second time in a row we had been acquired by Skillsoft. And I moved to San Francisco to be, you know, in the head office. I thought I'd learn a lot from their C-level staff, who really paid me no attention. I thought that there was, you know, now finally people will get it, you know, but no. I was still 25 years old or whatever at this point.
And you're so from the Miramichi? Like,
yeah,
give
exactly.
me a break. Who do you think you are?
Yeah. Meanwhile, like looking back, you know, the CFO of the company, he left. You know, he was the working with the Supreme Court justice, and then he left Skillsoft to go become CFO of Google. These are the people I was thinking should pay attention to me. It was crazy, you know. But anyway, that's You have to have confidence. If you don't have confidence, you know, you're not going to make it. It's only through irrational confidence that you persevere through the hard times.
I can already tell you, Jody, that's going to be one of our sound bites. But it's so good because you have to have that confidence to be take the risks, because if you don't, you're going to be stifled and petrified and so afraid of failing, you won't do it.
Not only that, you have to instill your irrational confidence in others.
In others.
Because, you know, like when I started IntraHive, for example, I had to, you can't start a company, it's very difficult to start a company and be successful with adequate people. You need like really, really good people. Mm-hmm. And really, really good people are already working somewhere else a lot of the time. And they're usually treated really well there. So you have to try to get them to be irrational and quit their perfectly good job at a great company and come work at some unstable new startup. You know, that's part of your job as a CEO, you know, and a founder. It's really difficult. And then the next thing you need to do is try to raise money from somebody when you're a first-time founder. And that's not a really rational thing when they can choose among a lot of different companies to invest in. And then if you pull that one off, well, then you have to build a product and sell it to a company. There's that first customer, it's going to be the first time anybody's ever bought it, and they have to pay real money for it.
Yeah.
So those are really hard things. So somehow you have to have this like confidence coming through that it makes them feel confident in their decision.
Well, it's not like there's a playbook that says Monday you're going to do this and Tuesday you're going to do this. Like, as you're describing all of those stages of trying to get off the ground and grow, to this day, there's no playbook that works for everybody. So you are tilling new soil all the time.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. That's probably what I've loved the most about the job, is that there's always something new. And even, you know, at this point now, I've been at it for, well, 20 years, I guess, you know, my job is still, I could say, quite different this year than it was last year.
Last year. So how did you go from being in California to deciding, well, maybe I should go back to university? And what am I going to take? How did that happen?
Yeah, well, so in 2001, I sold the company. And then the office in San Francisco shut down, and people were a lot of people were given the choice. You know, you can move to Waltham, Massachusetts, and work for the, you know, the new head office up there, or you can just take a package.
Yeah.
So I didn't bother trying to rally for Waltham. I really liked the energy of San Francisco. I stayed there for a couple of years, just doing nothing basically. Working through different ideas for a next startup and everything. And then I started thinking that I should maybe go home. And I thought, you know, the market's just not great for starting something in, you know, 2001, 2002, 2003. We were in the middle of a crash. I was really nervous about starting something in a bad time when it's really, at that point, it was almost impossible to raise money and so on. Yeah. So I thought, like, well, maybe this is the time when I can go back and actually get a degree. I thought that would do two things. One, it would instill some confidence in future investors when I go to do my next thing. It would make my mom proud because nobody from our family had ever went to university. And mm-hmm. And then finally, I'd hopefully learn some stuff that I didn't know. And so that was really why. I thought that I'd rather at the time maybe go do my business degree than my computer science degree, because I had a lot of years really of computer engineering experience, and I thought, you know, knowing more about like the business environment, like micro and macroeconomics, and how to make financing decisions, and like learning more about marketing, that there might be some good things to learn throughout that process.
Far more interesting way to round out the skills to match the confidence you'd been building and build on top of it.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, I think it's really interesting as a mom to say that you wanted to make your mom proud. I'm sure she was proud of the work that you had done, but there's sometimes for some parents that having that post-secondary certificate feels like a big deal for a family.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it did, you know, and my mom was born in 1929. She was a lot older than me when, she was a lot older than most when she had me. She was in her mid 40s. And so, you know, she only went to grade 8. To her, to have some, you know, one of her kids go to, you know, do their degree was a pretty big
deal. It's a big deal. Yeah, that's a pretty special part of your story to go back and do that. How did it feel to be an older student at UMB?
I was just amazed. I mean, first of all, I didn't mind it at all. I think at the time I was maybe 29 or 30. and I didn't mind it at all. I actually got along really well with all the classmates and everything. And I was just amazed at how different it was this time around. I felt really engaged in every single course. I was got almost all straight A's or A pluses. It was just so easy. But it wasn't easy because all of a sudden I was smarter. It was easy just because I finally put in, you know, I was finally motivated. And I saw this, there's a famous YouTuber, I can't remember his name, but he talks about this exact point where it's, I think that it's not that people are smart and so therefore they can be good at math or whatever it is. I think it's people start to believe that they're good at math and so they become good at math. You just have to be motivated and it makes such a difference in your ability to succeed.
I do work with high school girls and we talk about that growth mindset and how do you help them understand that you can always be building skills. You're not born great at math. You might think you're born really good at some things. And there are some things that people are naturally talented towards, but it's stuff you have to work at it. And I always say, if you don't have a passion for it, man, it's going to be hard to get really good at it because there's equal amounts of passion that needs to go into it. So you found a career, you found a curriculum that made you passionate. I have to ask, was it intimidating when it was time to get up and present and you're telling a story about IC Global or scholars.com and getting bought out and, you know, these other 22-year-old students are going, what the hell? Like, this is like a whole other experience than me. You must have opened some eyes along the way.
I think it was like everybody in my classes generally knew because you know, we would, you know, we'd be working on group projects where you're in groups of like three or four on a lot of different subjects. Mm-hmm. And I think people just really, I wouldn't say they treated me special, but, you know, we would definitely, it would make for some really interesting projects, you know, because when people are thinking about like, well, what are we going to do for a marketing project? We wouldn't be thinking about the lemonade stand so much or whatever. We'd be thinking about things with a bigger view, you know, because I'd been out there in the world for a while.
Yeah. I'd want to be in your team.
I think it was fun, you know. I think we had, it was good I loved it. I loved my time there.
So you graduated and I know that you eventually made your way to do your master's degree. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that and how did you figure out that you wanted to do a bit more?
While I was at Chalk, I had learned to fly airplanes, and I bought an airplane and I was living in Northern Virginia. I started visiting my friend who lived up in Boston quite a bit. And I just, you know, I had been starting to realize that in different conversations with investors, people would see me as having a business. People tend to want to see somebody as an electrician or a plumber, not both, you know, and that's what I've learned. And so people would say, you know, are you a hacker or are you a hustler? You know, which is it? Are you a business guy or are you a tech guy?
Technical guy, yeah.
And as soon as I got my business degree, all of a sudden people started thinking I didn't have technical skills. And it was the strangest thing, because right before that, they thought I had technical skills and no business experience. So mm-hmm. it's just really strange, but it bugged me for quite a few years. Well, quite a few being maybe two or three. and then I decided, well, why don't I just go do that too? I can do some of the courses online. I can fly back and forth, stay with my friend, and do it while I'm doing, my COO role that I had at Chalk. And yeah, so I did that and graduated from Harvard in 2011.
And how long did it take you to do that? I love how you just slipped in. It was Harvard. Yes, you graduated from Harvard with your master's degree in management information systems.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. It took me about 4 years or so to do that. It was really difficult because, you know, I had so many things going on at once, competing for my time. There was that. And I was trying to make sure that my grades were top, you know, A's. At the same time, we were in a really busy period at Chalk, and we had tons of opportunities going on, and things were really taking off with BlackBerry and Samsung and all the rest. And we were, you know, going through various periods of raising money. It was you know, very hard on my time, but yeah, in the end, I ended up managing to get it done in about 4 years or so.
And tell us a little bit about Chalk Media for those who wouldn't know, you know, another company that you were successful with.
Yeah, so in 2005, my original plan was, I thought, well, how am I going to learn sales? You can't really go, well, at least my thought was, you can't really learn how, like, sales, going to take a course in it. I don't know whether that's true or not anymore, but that's what I thought. I thought, well, why don't I just go take an entry-level sales job and just do the job for 2 or 3 months, and I'll, you know, learn what it's like to actually be a salesperson, prospecting all the way through to close. And so I like put the feelers out. I thought, well, you know, I have a lot of years of e-learning experience and assisting sales closing deals because of my years at Scholars and at IC Global. So I didn't really think of what it would look like from the other side. But I was like, you know, there's a big Canadian e-learning company called Chalk Media. I think there were two or three others at the time that I applied to be a sales guy. Desire to Learn might have been one of them. I don't remember. Apparently from the other side, they saw my resume came in and they were like, this is really weird.
I was going to interrupt you and say, that doesn't feel like the job you applied for.
Yeah. Yeah. They said, like, well, whatever. If he wants the job, let's do it. Let's try him out. And so I went in and I was in a class with a couple other salespeople, and we did this. You know, they brought me through sales training, and then I had my phone and I had to start calling. And it was, I thought I was just going to do really well, you know, because I figured there's always, like, perseverance always seems to prevail. And oh my God, that job was hard. It was way harder than I expected. You know, you're just like getting hung up on constantly. I mean, that's probably less so once you're really good at it. But this is my first sales job. I had never done prospecting ever in my life. And I was just getting hung up on, and it was hard being as timid as I was, really, to continually get hung up on and told off and everything else when you're trying to prospect. And for a good 2 months or so, I felt like I wasn't making any progress at all. And, you know, in the cube next to me, I was in a cube. And in the cube next to me, this girl, Sherry, I could tell she was just making progress. She was just, like, bringing people to the next stage. She wasn't necessarily getting them closed, but I could tell she was having more progress in prospecting than I was. And then one day it just clicked, and I don't know exactly what it was. But I just kept on going until it eventually clicked, and I think it was a really great experience. Yeah, and then I guess the rest of the story is I ended up selling the largest software deal in the Chalk's history to a company called Inventive. Then I ended up getting pulled out of sales. he asked if I would be VP of strategy. I was ready to leave at that point anyway, but he asked if I would kind of join him as a partner. So I became VP of strategy and then COO and CTO and really led everything except for finance and sales. So I had marketing and all of the operations and tech and product and all that.
So you're a pretty confident guy. While you're doing all of this, your time at Chalk Media, you're also doing your master's. Mm-hmm. How did your confidence level go from, I'm doing really great work at IC Global, I went to school, got great grades, landed in a sales job. Man, I thought this was going to be a lot easier than I thought. How did the confidence level go? Like, it feels like it would be quite a wave going, what the heck am I doing? I should be running the dev team around here. There must have been moments of that. How did you work your way through it?
Yeah, that hits you a lot. You know, maybe not in the last year, but I feel like throughout my career, I remember numerous times at numerous of these companies, we got to the point where we were going to run out of money and all the employees would have realized it. And I had to drain my bank account to make it through one more payroll because I was pretty sure this deal is going to close. And it did, you know, or whatever it is. Or you're pretty sure you're going to win some big deal and then you don't. There's so many setbacks along the way. I remember when I was starting IntraHive and we put in all this work and we had what at the time, which was a pretty famous investor called GrowTech. They said that they were going to write a check. I think they were going to give us like $5 million on a $10 million pre-money valuation, which was huge at the time for us. And then at the last second, they said no. Salesforce Chatter came out and they said, oh, nope, we don't want to compete with that, and pulled the deal. There's been so many of those moments, you know? And I think, though, that the older I get, you realize that they're just moments.
Yeah.
And that if you just keep on pushing harder than everybody else, or at least that's the way I've always said it to my family and to the people who work with me, is I feel like if you'll put in the effort that 99% of people won't do, then you might have a shot at getting the rewards that 1% of the people get.
But you had a good role. I mean, you've obviously worked hard, Jody, there's no question about it. How do you deal with the people who think you're an overnight success with the latest announcement? I mean, I just find those are comedic, and they must feel that way because this is no overnight success. You've been going hard at it for 20 plus years.
Yeah, and then, you know, because I was kind of, although I was confident, I was pretty shy in my early career. So anytime there was an award to be accepted by the company or anything like that, my mom always had this thing saying like, oh, this person's bragging or whatever, right? And so I would purposely not accept awards most of the time, and I'd send someone else to go, you know, get the award, or I'd
pick them up,
try to refer it to somebody else and everything. And that just happened for the longest time. So I think like they're probably... would be a perception, if anybody even knows who I am, you know, there would be a perception like, why, why now? Mm-hmm. But really, you know, I guess it's, to me, it feels like I've always been working hard at this kind of stuff, and I've had successes that people don't even realize I've
know
had.
About. Yeah. So how do you finish up at Chalk Media and find your way to starting another company?
So Chalk Media... So when I joined it, we were a content company. Very quickly on, we decided to rework the company into a software company. It was growing really, really fast. We signed up great customers like AT&T and Verizon, and we were growing exponentially. And then the crash of 2008 happened, mm-hmm. and we were afraid. We didn't know whether we could make it through that or not, because we were growing fast, but we were not profitable, and we didn't have enough funding. And people were not writing checks. They were all scared. And so we luckily managed to get the company sold for a pretty good price to BlackBerry. I worked at BlackBerry for a little bit, a year or two, and then started realizing that there was a pretty big opportunity to be made in optimizing how people sell. And I always kept this little book where I would like come up with different ideas for what my next startup might be, because I've always been engaged in something really fun. And so when I came up with a startup idea, it wasn't something I wanted to stop what I'm doing to do, but I thought I should note that in case it's relevant, you know, when the time comes.
Yeah.
And so I just, you know, I thought at a certain point, like, I think the time is right to go after this category. And so I at the time, BlackBerry was just starting to lay off everybody. And I thought, well, why don't I just wait until BlackBerry lays me off, and then I'll go start something.
I'll start. Okay.
Yeah. And there were 200 people in my group, and they cut everybody but me, every single person. And I think it's because, it's not because I was so talented or anything. I think it's because I hinted to them that I wanted to go.
You wanted a package.
Yeah. And oh my, it was insane. My boss was fired. By the end of it, I was reporting directly to Jim Balsillie, and I don't even know if he knew it. You know, I looked in the org chart. I was like, whoa, how did this happen? Yeah, it was really crazy. So in the end, I just ended up having to quit and leave all of the package that would have happened eventually, and just went for it. I had a completely different idea when I first got going, as most people do. A completely different way of going at it. And then we kind of landed on what we have now, which we feel like we're onto a huge category, that in the longer run, there's going to be two systems that people want to adopt. One is the place where all the salespeople put their information, their stuff, the CRM. So it's all of your contacts and your records of meetings and all these kinds of things. And then you're going to have the system that makes your salespeople sell better. All of your revenue generators generate more revenue. So that's the category that we've been kind of collectively inventing between us and a few other companies.
So do you think, I'm curious, did your time at Chalk Media really influence in that sales role? Did it really influence what you thought could come of IntroHive?
Yeah, I think if I had not sat in the sales seat, I wouldn't have experienced the pain and really understood what could help salespeople and sales leaders and everything. I got a much more 360-degree view of the problems that were existing. And I just feel like that's one of the areas that's really ripe for optimization, because there's lots of buyers out there who have bad experiences where they'll go through this whole process of like explaining everything that they want, and then the person will say, hang on one second, and they transfer you through to someone else, and you have to repeat yourself all over again. Or like somebody's
totally
asking you the wrong questions or being frustrating in some way. It's frustrating for salespeople because they're being told by their sales leaders, oh, just go look up this person on LinkedIn, every person in the meeting, and then just go to the company's website and go research the news and go in the CRM and look up all of the opportunities you have with them. Go into LinkedIn also and see who knows who, and maybe there's some people you can reference and see if there's any things you can start conversations about. Maybe you're both Leafs fans. It's crazy. How could somebody possibly do that before every meeting?
Yeah. It's fascinating to think about the path it took to get you here. Did you take some time off before you got IntroHive going, and how'd you make your way back to wanting to do this in New Brunswick? So let's get back into New Brunswick a little bit.
Yeah, so all of my ventures I started in New Brunswick. Most of them, the first two I was living there at the time. Chalk Media, I wasn't living there at the time. But once we decided that we were going to rework the entire company, we basically cut 95% of the staff and started over as a software company. All of the software people that I knew were in New Brunswick. Like I mentioned this problem of you need really talented people. Everybody really talented that I knew in my network were in Fredericton. And so it became the obvious choice. And then with IntroHive, at the time I was living in Miami. And again, I had this same problem. Like I wanted some of the same people that I worked with in the past, Mike Waugh and some of the, Jacob O'Reilly and some of the people that I really just had a strong bond with and knew I could trust and everything. And they're just really good, strong, driven guys. And so that's why I ended up hiring people back there. I remember, though, not to pick on anyone in particular, but I remember going to all of the major investors in New Brunswick when I was trying to raise money, when this thing was first getting going. And nobody would invest in me at the time because they thought I wasn't New Brunswick enough. And, you know, I wasn't Miami enough to be Miami, and I wasn't New Brunswick enough to be New Brunswick. And so that was really frustrating. For the longest time, it was probably a good year that I couldn't raise money, and I had to completely drain my bank account for that reason.
Isn't that interesting? With a degree from UMB, heritage from the Miramichi, telling you, people forget, don't they? They have short memories maybe a little bit.
I think they thought it was some kind of a trick, you know, like, well, you know, you're just trying to get the New Brunswick money or whatever. But it's like, if you're going to hire all of your people in New Brunswick, what other option do you have other than New Brunswick money? you don't have any choice. And it was my entire network, and it's where my office was and everything else. So I really didn't have any choice.
So you started in 2012. Where do you have offices now for IntroHive?
London, Miami, Chicago, San Francisco, Toronto, Fredericton, St. John, Halifax, and then a lot of home-based people in a lot of other cities.
Yeah. And you and I chatted during the pandemic, and you said things were on fire for you during the pandemic. You were making great progress.
Yeah, in February and March of 2020, things were horrible. We went through this period where sales just pretty much stopped. And it was really scary for a while. I think everybody was just completely scared and didn't want to spend money, or we weren't doing it right. But something, we just cracked the code on it around April, and we sold more deals in a week than we had ever sold before. And they were small deals, but they were deals. And that was coming off the back of no deals at all in over, I don't know, a month or two. So it was pretty, all of a sudden, just everything just took off. We had done a bunch of things, so it wasn't that we just sat around and all of a sudden things started. We immediately, as soon as the pandemic hit, we immediately went into crisis mode, and we were meeting with Jeff White from NBIF all the time, and we were trying to figure out how to get interim financing and how do we build some product that's really relevant to help people that are suffering from the pandemic, remote work stuff and things like that, sales acceleration. And I think then we changed all of our marketing to reposition so that people saw that we could be the solution to the pandemic, not the extra cost in the pandemic.
Yes.
And that really helped accelerate us at that point.
Well, I'm glad I talked to you in the fall when things were much brighter than when they were at the start of the pandemic. Tell me about, how do you describe IntroHive?
So really, IntroHive is a system meant to help all companies with revenue. Right now, we've been focusing vertical by vertical by vertical by vertical, and we've been focusing on primarily B2B sellers, like business-to-business sellers. But that just keeps on growing. We just keep expanding who we're selling to and what our product does. But really, if you think of the broader vision, we think that it doesn't really do you any good to sell if you're losing sales every time things come up for renewal. So we think it's really important that you focus on revenue and retention.
Yes.
And we think one of the main ways that you can add a little extra to it is if you're really maximizing everybody in the firm's relationships. So we call that formula the 3 R's, revenue, retention, and relationships. And we feel like if you have all three of those really dialed in, that you're going to drive revenue to a level that you couldn't do in do before. Now, we ourselves have like really unusual retention. Our retention rate is always talked about by investors as one of the best in the industry, like not just in the industry, but in the software industry. And I think we figured out a long time ago how to not just sell customers, but keep them. And so, you know, part of it is just, you know, eating our own dog food or drinking our own champagne. But I think we've cracked the code on something really important.
Well, it costs a lot to get a new customer versus retain an existing one. And that's something we're taught way early in our careers.
Yeah. And also it's a sign of customer happiness. Yeah. And if you have happy customers, they're going to refer you more business as well.
So rapid fire about the business. How many employees do you have now?
We're just over 300.
And how many are in New Brunswick or Atlantic Canada even?
About 150 to 200.
And what does Atlantic Canada mean to the business in your eyes?
Atlantic Canada is really where it all started. It's, I used to think of it as just New Brunswick, but that's very quickly expanded to Nova Scotia as well. We've just got a really strong presence now in Nova Scotia from people who've been with us for a long time. So I think it's starting to be a whole story for Atlantic Canada, which I think is really cool.
And I know some of your early folks were people like Jerry Carr and Dave Alston. So you've had some NB strong brands. Maybe not everyone knows all of those brands, but you've had strong people from here. And would you consider that to be one of the things that has led to your success?
Yeah, I think I've always tried to surround myself with people that were really strong and people who are going to give great ideas and push really hard. Like I put, you know, Mike Waugh and Jacob and Sarah Vannon and, you know, some of those people in that category as well. They might not be as well known, but they're really, really strong. Were with me very early. Mike Waugh was employee number one or two.
Yeah.
And just really, really strong. Jerry, I worked on Jerry for years. I think Marcel helped me tip him over the line because it was just, for the longest time, he was going to retire and that was that. Didn't want to really be, you know, it's like, wish you all well and I'll, you know, help you as much as I can with advice, but don't really think I want to go do a new thing. And then eventually I cracked him and he came over.
He's not retired. I was emailing with him this week and I've got a meeting with him on Monday. So
he's definitely not retired. He is a force at Intrahive.
Yeah, it's really interesting that, you know, you said with some of your earlier ventures, it was the talent that was here. And I think there's really enterprise architecture and development and product management and program management talent that is here because of companies like yours and Salesforce and Cvent. And there's others that have really demonstrated that we do have that software development capability that exists here in Atlantic Canada. And I think we're really proud of that.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it kind of, a lot of it to me feels like it started back in the early 90s with Frank McKenna. You know, he was involved really early on just trying to make sure that we had tech entrepreneurship start really early. And I think that's really great. I hear he's doing some other really great stuff with the McKenna Institute and all that. I'm really excited to see that come to fruition.
Yeah, I would tell you that in my meetings with him, it's just nonstop, same level of energy that he had at that point when he was creating the digital highway. And he's got lots of vision and he's got a great team and it's going to be really fun working on kind of that vision. And they've got some neat things to do and it's really, really going to be exciting, I think, for the region. Tell me, I want to talk a couple minutes about raising capital. And of course, you just closed a huge deal, but you've been closing money long before that. So don't go right into, you know, your big announcement last week, but talk to me about the process of raising capital for other entrepreneurs who are in that process and people who don't understand the depth of time and skill it takes to raise money.
Yeah, I remember, I think the first time I tried to raise money was in the late or mid 90s or whatever, when I was starting IC Global. And I remember people telling me that I should write a business plan and then talk to this investor in Nova Scotia, who was the only one that anybody really knew at the time. It was, I think they're called ACG or something like that. And so I did all that and I got the meeting and, you know, we ended up giving our pitch. We didn't really know what we were supposed to pitch because there were no resources online telling you how to pitch or what does a good pitch deck look like, or even that you should have a pitch deck. Yeah. We just prepared ourselves for a presentation and a demo, or conversation and a demo. And in the end, he was interested, but didn't move forward. That was my first attempt at it. And then, you know, I started to read an awful lot more about it, like what is in a successful fundraise. And really it comes down to understanding what it is that makes an investor make their decision. So like an investor wants to know that the market that you're selling into is huge, that you're not creating a new point of sale system for lemonade stands, not to pick on the lemonade guys, but yeah. It's, you know, that your market is huge, that it's going to generate pretty good amount of money in a broad group of people, and it's going to recur. That's the easiest way to raise money. And they also want to know, this is where the puzzle all comes into play, because somehow your story has to make sense that although this is going to be a huge category, that people are going to be throwing money at that category, but somehow you have a competitive advantage that nobody else can have.
Yeah.
And then to make it kind of worse is that in order to make that story really make sense, it generally has to be something that wouldn't have been possible 5 years ago. Because otherwise, if it was such a great idea, somebody would have did it 5 years ago.
So, and you just haven't found the company that did it. So they think you haven't done your homework.
That's right. That's right. And you have to be really good at going through all that. Like, so what's my idea? What's the progress I've shown? What's my unique competitive advantage? What are the moats, you know, they say? Go through the list of competitors. Don't try to say that there are none. Even if there's people who will enter the market, you know, it's better. That's better than saying that you don't have competitors. Going through a good financial analysis, so you're showing, okay, well, here's how much I think I can generate this quarter or this year, and with a lot of granularity, not just like, well, there's, you know, 10,000 people, and I figure I can get 10% of them. That's how I think.
Yeah.
We all start, right? But it shouldn't be that way. Like at IntroHive, we say, okay, well, we're going to have these people selling to small businesses, these people selling to mid-sized businesses, these people selling to large. This is how many people we think we can market to. This is how many leads we think we'll generate. Of those leads, we think we'll have a conversion rate of this. It's going to take us, you know, 6 months to a year to close each one. And you plot this all out on a spreadsheet. It's very time consuming. And unless you put in the time to do all that homework, nobody else is going to have the confidence to invest in the business, or you won't get past that friends and family part, at least.
Yeah. So you've had to do this a couple times.
Yeah, a lot. Yeah. At Chalk, I think we raised something like $20 million, $7 million at one point, and then it got bigger. And then at IntroHive, we raised quite a few rounds of financing. We did our seed round and then our A round and our B round and then what they call a B prime, which is kind of a second piece of the B round, and then the C round.
So let's finish off on your C round, because it was a pretty big day here when you announced that last week in New Brunswick. So talk to us how that all came together.
Yeah, so we decided in the fall that we thought we were ready to raise a C round. A C round is kind of a special round for companies in that you have to prove, if you research it, you'll see that it's at different stages, you kind of have to have proved different things. So in a seed round, maybe it's that you have a good idea and you know generally about the market and stuff. You have a decent chance of maybe making it. By the A round, you probably have to have proven that you there's a product market fit that, you know, customers will buy. And then it kind of goes like that. By the C round, what you're really trying to prove is that you're an efficient business and that you're growing rapidly. And that if somebody puts in a dollar, they're going to make 10. You know, it's like that. And so generally they want you to be pretty big in revenue. They want to be able to pick apart every single department and see that it can scale. By scale, it just means like you can 10x if you really need to. Like if they put in 10 times the money, you can get 10 times bigger. And they really, 10 isn't even good enough, really. They want to make sure that you can someday go IPO, because that's what really C round is about, is funding you potentially for an IPO someday down the road.
So how did this round come together for you? How did you get the partners that you got?
So we hired Bank of America. We went through a process where we interviewed different investment banking companies that represent private placements. That's really what you call raising money in the private markets. Yep. And we decided to do it with a banker this time instead of doing it on our own, because the stakes were so high. And we wanted to just make sure that our materials, I talked about the importance of preparation. We wanted to make sure our materials were taken to another level. And Bank of America did a really good job in that. They, as good as we thought our pitch deck was, I think it's night and day how they tightened up the story. And then they went out and, you know, we had a lot of inbound interest from investors all the time. Almost every few days, I'd have another email from an investor. And so we kept lists and we funneled that off to Bank of America. And then they had their own lists of people that they thought would be a good fit for us. And then they just started calling. And then there was silence for about 2 weeks. And then all of a sudden, we wondered actually if they were doing anything. And then we started to hear that there were a bunch of meetings. There were a bunch of like investors that wanted to talk to us. And we kind of just worked through the funnel, the sales process, but with investors. Investing is really, it's just another sales process. Instead of selling product, you're selling stock. You know, so you work everybody through the process all the way to the end. You try to get everybody to reach the end at the same time so that you don't have a mistiming issue and that people are all bidding at the same time, you know? And that's, they helped us a lot with all of that stuff. And then, we had multiple term sheets at the end, and then we selected Providence Strategic Growth as our investor.
And it was great. MBIF got in as well. So you had a bit of New Brunswick nearby all the way along, which is wonderful.
And BDC. MBIF. I was really happy to get the support of some Canadian investors, because it's kind of, I really think that Canada should be a part of this story going forward, not just in the past.
Yeah. Well, you've made it an Atlantic story, and I think we need more of those in order for us to continue to see the growth we want to have here. So let's finish off. University dropout. Microsoft extraordinaire on the certification process. And I know that well, because we used to give, when I worked at T4G, we used to give bonuses once you got your Microsoft certifications. Like, it was a big deal. It was part of those performance bonuses. And that's still the case today. You know, things like that are completely relevant.
Yeah.
You decide, you find your way into some startups, you get your master's at Harvard, you go to Chalk Media at the same time doing some cool things, and you start a new company. You knew from grade five you were going to do entrepreneurship. How did that, how does it feel now thinking about that technical background that I, even though I didn't get my computer science degree, that's always been the focus. You've always been in the software business, in the digital media business. How big of a role did all of that from your high school and university play throughout your entire career?
Yeah, I think it played a huge role. You know, I think if I didn't do that, I probably would have did some other kind of business. But I love the software business. It's such a fun thing to be able to build this software that gets in deployed in so many people's hands. You can, you know, we have over 100,000 users in a single company at PwC. It's just amazing to think that everybody wakes up and is using your product. And the great thing about a software business is, like, you're not constrained by a supply chain. Like, I don't have to go build, you know, if I'm a toy company, I have to go build a million toys and then get them deployed to stores to get them in the hands of a million people. With software, it doesn't work like that. You know, you make copies and it just, you turn it on and that's it. So it's just, that's why you see now tech companies are most of the fastest growing companies in the world, because they're the most scalable companies, and that just creates a lot of fun.
Talk to me about what the next chapter, I'm sure you're not near retirement, but what does the next chapter look like for you at IntroHive?
So right now we are focused on putting together the next stage of plans for how to get to, say, 100 million US in revenue. Mm-hmm. And so it's going to be, you know, that'll be a couple of years to reach that, but I think we'll do it. And the faster we can make that happen, we're going to pull out all the stops to make it happen like we always do. You know, so we're trying to figure out, okay, well, what's the fastest we can grow organically? And there's a really good exercise that Marcel had talked to me about one time, which I really strongly believe in, which is, instead of thinking about, like, how can I get twice as big, think about, you know, why can't I grow by 5x this year? Well, that's not possible because we don't have enough salespeople. Well, why? Well, because we can't recruit them fast enough. Well, can you solve that problem? Well, okay, well, we could get more recruiters. Well, maybe we have to hire in other regions or whatever the problem is. There's always a scale point, like a choking point that stops your growth. Mm-hmm. And by setting the bar really, really high, it kind of makes it, it brings those points out obviously. Like, it makes it more obvious so that you know what problems you should at least be focusing on. Doesn't necessarily mean you're going to grow 5X, but you'll find the choking points a little bit sooner, which makes all the difference. So that's really what we're focused on, is like growing organically as fast as we can, possibly looking at some small acquisitions for things that make sense. And yeah, it's just going to be a lot of fun.
Well, it's a pleasure to talk to you and for you to take the time to tell us a little bit about your story. Not that, you know, it's exciting to hear the kind of, you know, when you raise $100 million, and it's the largest equity US and it's the largest equity investment deal in New Brunswick history. That's a story in itself. But what we're always trying to do on the podcast is tell people's story, tell the story of the region, and hopefully provide some inspiration for others. And you certainly, with your team, and I know it takes a village to make this all happen, but this story started in the Miramichi. And it's an exciting story to be able to talk about here as someone who's working in New Brunswick and trying to tell the stories of New Brunswickers who are doing great things. And you're doing an amazing job for all of the region and putting us on the map. So for that, we thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much. I love the format of this podcast. I think, like, telling people's stories is a really great way to do it. It's really hard to, you know, just sit and listen to somebody talk about business. So sometimes if you can actually get to know that there's a person there that had ups and downs and, like, you know, follow the crooked path to where they get to, sometimes I think it makes it a lot more interesting.
Interesting. Pay attention. Well, I think your story about sales is one that we need to tell a whole lot more, because it is learning all the pieces of the business. So that's going to stick with me for a long time. So I'm really glad to have learned that piece too. And I can't thank you enough, Jody.
Yeah, thanks, Kathy.
To quote Jody, if you don't have confidence, you're not going to make it. It's only through irrational confidence that you persevere through the hard times. What a great quote there, Jody, and thanks for those insights. What did I tell you, everybody? A masterclass on entrepreneurship, on grit, on what it takes. I had such a great time talking to Jody and learning from him on everything from his formula for success that I thought was so insightful, the three R's, revenue, retention, and relationships, to his educational journey and the ties with his mother that have had such an impact on his life's decisions. There were so many twists and turns that has led to so many unique experiences, opportunities, successes, and now as a CEO of a wildly successful company that started here in Atlantic Canada. There were so many things that stood out for me today from Jody's experiences and what he shared that can teach us all a thing or two. Like, he had this desire to learn about technology from a very young age, long before he went to university, and he pursued it passionately. It has fueled so much of his career. He went back to school and built new skills in areas he thought he needed in order to have the success he desired. Then eventually on to Harvard for his master's in MIS, which brought him deep into software engineering and product and his time in sales. And when he went into that role, it probably didn't make sense for a lot of people, but he wanted that practical sales experience. And nothing brings you closer to customers than sales and you understanding what needs to go into a successful product. He knew this experience would serve him well, as hard as it was. I also loved when he talked about having a little book with different ideas for the next startup and jotting those down, as you never know when an idea is going to be the right one at the right time. I loved his honesty when he talked about jobs being harder. It's what we all need to hear. It takes passion, grit, tenacity, drive, perseverance. And he said over and over again, a ton of hard work to build a product that is scalable and a company that's scalable, that has a unique fit. And it also takes capital, and why the announcements of the past couple of weeks have just been so significant for the organization. Jody talked about the effort that goes into making something really special and building this company with people he trusts and have that drive and passion as well. Jody knows it takes a community. What is extra special about this story is while he's gone from the Miramichi to California and back to New Brunswick and Boston and Miami, to name a few spots, and while living in Miami, he is still firmly planted in New Brunswick. And his love for Atlantic Canada and the tech scene here remains strong. We hope to continue to see IntroHive grow its offices here, and we are cheering you, Jody, and the entire team every step of the way. Congratulations to all of you. Be sure to check out the show notes on the blog at techimpact.it, and I hope you enjoyed this one as much as I did. Have a good one.